This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. All right, this week continuing on with the second half of Deconstructing Settler Socialism with Gia Vogel. But before that, Lori Wallach was on the Ralph Nader Hour a few weeks ago talking about the tariffs. So let's see if her predictions are right, and I'm sure they are. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media. No one seems to know what effect the Trump tariffs will have on the economy, the environment, or the working class. On a recent installment of the Ralph Nader Hour, Doctor of Law Lori Wallach cuts the coupon out of the inflation rhetoric with Steve Scroven, David Feldman, and the Raider of the Lost Authoritarian himself.
Hey, do you like roller coasters? Then you'll love Donald Trump's tariff policy. David?
Lori Wallach is a 30-year veteran of international U.S. congressional trade battles, starting with the 1990s fights over NAFTA and WTO when she founded the Global Trade Watch Group at Public Citizen. She is now the director of the Rethink Trade Program at the American Economic Liberties Project and a senior advisor to the Citizens Trade Campaign, a national coalition of unions and environmental, consumer, faith, family farm, and other civil society groups working for social and environmental justice and trade policy. Welcome back to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Lori Wallach.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back, Lori. Our listeners are ready to get educated on this whole subject of tariffs, which Donald Trump seems to be unilaterally articulating and dominating in the news.
These guys are just doing, it's basically like trying to build a house with just a hammer. We are against saws. We are against screwdrivers. We do not actually believe in nails, no other tools. We will just hammer a bunch of wood. And as a result, we're going to make some noise and we're definitely going to break some things, but we're not actually building a new redistributed trade system, which we could.
Well, you know, listeners should know that Lori Wallach has this very clear and elaborate evaluator on Trump's tariff trade deals in terms of what they impact the U.S. And I want you to go through the ones because you flash some are green and some are red in terms of their impact. But just from the point of view of the consumer listening, we have a weaker dollar now. The tariffs are starting to bite on some consumer products, clothing, for example. Give us an update on how it's beginning to affect the pocketbook, the weaker dollar and the transfer of tariffs to consumer price increases.
Unless you're a recovering trade attorney like me, you hear about these deals, you hear the parts of them, and you're like, what does that mean for my life? Like, what is that? A non-tariff barrier. Do I care about that? Can I eat that? Do we import that? So what I basically did is I boiled it down to English, and this is to evaluate when they announce these deals. So like, let's just talk about Brazil. Let's put Brazil, the deals with Brazil that have been announced in the last couple of days. Let's just put it through the evaluator. So what the evaluator does is it has a list of the things that you would have in these policies if you were trying to deliver on Trump's promises. Number one, to rebuild American manufacturing. Again, that's a good goal. We should do that. To create good manufacturing jobs, we should do that, and to rebalance trade. And we need to do that. There are things you would do if you were trying to actually do what he said he was going to do. And then there are a whole bunch of things that you would definitely not do unless you're like trying to just help big pharma, big tech, you know, the usual neoliberal garbage. So the green stuff on this tariff deal tester are the things that all of us consumers should look at and see, all right, is this actually going to deliver? So it's things like, number one, the things should target countries we have a trade deficit with. You shouldn't go after the countries where we are selling them more stuff than we are importing. That would be counterproductive to actually raise the cost of trading. So let's look at Brazil. We actually have a trade surplus with Brazil. We do not have a deficit with Brazil. So number one, no, it is not a deficit country. So that's not looking optimistic that this is a deal that's actually about what Trump said he was going to do. Does it have rules that counter environmental dumping, i.e. externalizing environmental costs by basically dumping toxins in the air, the water, the ground? No, it does not have anything like that. Does it have something to counter wage suppression by busting unions? Because that's another way to trade cheat. You don't allow any kind of labor rights and no one can ever have a better wage. Nope, nothing in there about that. Does it discipline over capacity subsidies, the government intervening? Does it discipline the lack of competition enforcement? No, actually, a big Brazilian company is the big meatpacking monopolist. The U.S. has a food trade deficit for 10 years. Nothing in there on that. So you go through these different things that could make a difference. None of the good stuff is in that Brazil deal. All right, what the hell is in there? Okay, big tech oversight is weakened. Well, that's not good, but that's the number one thing they listed yesterday when they announced a new big trade investigation against Brazil. It's to investigate violations on Brazil abusing American big tech. And what they think is abusing is guaranteeing privacy rights online, trying to bust up the monopolies, trying to assure there's data security so we don't like get scammed. That's what they're doing for big tech, not for manufacturing, not for American consumers. That's basically abusing. It's like saying, hi, we want big tech to abuse you the way they abuse us here. We don't have any of these rules, Brazil. You need to like get rid of those rules. Or are there environmental policy attacks or food policy attacks or other things that are for big corporate interests? Well, there's a whole thing about intellectual property. Yes, they're actually trying to raise medicine prices in Brazil for big pharma instead of doing anything about U.S. jobs or U.S. trade balance. So if you go through the final one on this list, there are two final ones, but they're non-trade related things that get in the way of actually using the leverage of tariffs about jobs. And that's the number one thing with this Brazil deal. This Brazil deal is all about Trump basically trying to help Bolsonaro, Jair Bolsonaro, the former president of Brazil who lost, who then started a coup, who then failed to overthrow the government, and is now being tried for it. And perhaps Trump is having a but for the grace of God go I moment. But whatever it is, the dude is out there trying to help Bolsonaro. And he said it publicly when he announced the first tariffs of 50%. He said, this is about the abuse of my friend, Jair Bolsonaro. And then they've been backfilling, trying to have any economic sense. So on my evaluator, one of the things you get the worst score for is non-trade demands. Deal is conditioned on trade partners, ceding territory, geopolitical demands, and other untrade-related leverage. Well, that's what this whole thing is about. So literally, they're getting goodies for big tech and big pharma because Trump wants to help a failed wannabe dictator's coup, and there's no upside for U.S. workers, manufacturing, or trade balance. And that's how you use this to evaluate each one of the deals.
How do people get a hold of your evaluator? What website has it clearly on?
Rethinktrade.org. Rethinktrade.org. It's the number one thing on the top of the page.
I don't think listeners is anything like this in terms of comprehensively engaging you in the pluses and minuses of tariffs. I don't know who Trump listens to. Does he have technical advisors? Is it just off-the-cuff announcements on his Truth Social? Does he listen to anybody when he makes these announcements and zigs and zags and threats?
I'm sad to say, best I can tell, he's doing it on his own because on the regular, he's got some very good advisors. The guy who's the top trade ambassador is a very smart, capable guy. And on the regular, that guy and also his commerce secretary, his treasury secretary, say one thing. And then like within hours, Trump is doing something totally different. And so it is a mystery where some of this stuff actually is coming from. And best we can tell, the dynamic is something like Trump is so engaged in the fun and chaos, fun from his perspective, and chaos of throwing tariff news around like a lightning bolt that he really is not taking advice about from people who know how to do it, about how you could use tariffs to try and ostensibly achieve the things he promised. He's just enjoying throwing around tariffs. And the thing that, to get to your other question, Ralph, about what's it doing for consumers, again, if you go to rethinktrade.org, there are a couple of briefing papers about when tariffs do get passed through into consumer prices and when they don't, so that people can judge. It's not clear exactly how much pass-through is happening right now, actually, despite all these additional tariffs, because everyone says like, oh, he's put off the tariffs. But actually, we have more tariffs right now than we've had for 100 years, and thus the $100 billion of tariff revenue. But despite that, up until this most recent inflation read, there hasn't been an inflationary effect, which is to say that it's not being passed through yet.
Well, let me give you an example. There's probably our listeners buy products from L.L. Bean or Vermont Country Store. I checked the L.L. Bean catalog, and 96% of its products are imported, because they indicate after every product whether it's imported or not. Now, there's no way L.L. Bean is going to not increase prices to millions of its consumers around the country, is there?
Well, see, here's the question. So when L.L. Bean lists, say, you know, a T-shirt that is $20 or whatever, its cost to them coming from Vietnam or Bangladesh or China is a dollar, is 50 cents. It is so much less. And that's the landed price. That's the actual shirt. That's the schlepping it from Asia on a boat. That's the processing it. That is the tariff payment. That is them putting it in a truck and sending it to a distribution center. The markup in retail in most of these things is so high that there is room. So like, for instance, in the first round of tariffs, what the like most comprehensive study showed is that a lot of companies that had a lot of imports just absorbed into their, they basically took a little piece out of their profit margin. They absorbed the cost of the tariffs and didn't pass it through. And that's particularly in sectors where there's any kind of competition. If it's a total monopoly, they can get away with it. So like in the grocery store sector, you do see prices go up even when there aren't tariffs, because there's so few grocery chains and there's so few wholesalers that they can get away with it. But in other areas, there is more price competition and there is a huge markup. So like everyone who pays $120 for that pair of Nikes, the landed price for those shoes, again, the tariffs, the transportation, everything is $18, $20. So if there is even a 50% tariff on that, and it's not going to cost $30, you can still make a lot of money in between that markup. So depending, it's not passed on. The place where things get passed on is the stuff that's super cheap. So like the Walmart t-shirts that are in a package of three of them for $10, where it's closer to the margin, or the dollar store t-shirt that's $1.99, where like the cost of that's maybe 5 cents, that's more likely to get marked up a little bit. But it's pennies.
These are staggering markups that you just mentioned about L.L. Bean. Anyway, this is something for consumers to be very aware of, because Trump is afraid of inflation. The business community doesn't seem to be standing in any coordinated fashion on these tariffs. They seem to be in disarray or watchful waiting or just observing instead of their usual lobbying hard? Or is this going on behind the scenes, trying to get waivers and all?
I think it's a mix. I think that there are certain industries that have come to the conclusion that they're going to have to move their production out of China to different places. And they'd already started thinking about that for some period of time, almost as a national security measure. They've seen on a bipartisan basis now, for instance, high tariffs on China. Trump won, Biden kept them and raised them, Trump too. I think that there are sectors of retail importers, so like the clothing and footwear importers, the retailers, they still want to not have to make anything here. There are different sectors, I think, are responding differently. But I think, honestly, part of the reason why what's happening is industry goes to Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, and makes a special pleading and sometimes gets a special deal instead of saying anything publicly, is that they are afraid that Trump is going to personally go after their company and try and do some illegal thing that they can't stop fast enough in court, to try and shut them down, to hurt them in a way that is outside the rule of law.
The solar distribution industry is really hurting here, because they're going to see higher tariffs on solar panels from China.
Here's the story. The U.S. is now making solar panels because of the Biden policies that put together demand, so the tax credits that the Republicans have just gotten rid of, so we all want to get American solar, the investment in more capacity. The reason that Biden waited a year before putting the tariffs on the subsidized Chinese solar panels was so that we would have the ability to make more of them here. Because, Ralph, a bunch of that Chinese solar is actually being made by Uyghur forced labor. Like the silicon is being made in plants in the northwest corner of China by the million Muslim minority Uyghur, Tajik, and other residents of China, of Greater China, who are basically being rounded up and put into forced labor. We don't want that crap. Like, it's not only that if we have those kind of products coming here, we'll never be able to make our own, but also just as a moral matter, we don't want that stuff. The tariffs basically allow solar panels made in other Asian countries that don't use forced labor, that aren't subsidized illegally, etc. We are importing a bunch. But those Chinese panels, the industry that wants to just import the cheap ones and put them up is mainly a financing industry. They finance big projects. I'm on the side of the people who want to actually make them here and distribute them and then put them up with union labor. And there are two tracks of this. There's that team. And then there's team import them cheap and let me make a big return on my investment, because those are the ones that are the industrial scale, the big sort of financed projects where you have, you know, miles and miles of solar panels for utility. Those are the guys who want to take that grade of panels and bring them in. And it's basically how much return are they going to get in that investment? They could still make them in the U.S. and just make a little bit less return on their huge investment. But those are financing companies. I have less concern about how they go as compared to what happens to the companies are trying to actually manufacture them here, so we're not so reliant on imports.
Let's go to Steve.
Laura, you talked about tariff revenue and the tariffs that are in place, they are making money. Well, who is paying that money and who is getting that money?
So the money goes generally into the Treasury. It's not like going into like rebuilding U.S. manufacturing, which is where I would like for to see it go. And who's paying for it kind of depends on the arrangement with the companies involved. So the actual payment is made by the company that is importing the stuff. They pay the U.S. Treasury, and they do it through an agency called the Customs Department. And they do it at a customs office or online in a port. But practically, who's paying for it, a lot of it gets split. So for instance, a U.S. importer of clothes will say, hey, China, now your clothes have this tariff on them. And as a result, my profits are going to go down because my margin is big, but I want to make all the money, not just most of the money. And then they'll say, we're going to relocate our sourcing to Vietnam. This is our last order. Your tariffs suck. And then what typically happens is the company that's making the stuff in China that's selling it then will offer to split the tariff cost. And so the Chinese company will then pay the U.S. company half of it. And then the U.S. company actually pays the Treasury, but it's half of their money and half the tariffed country's money. And if you're a big enough purchaser, you can pull those kind of games because they don't want to lose, the manufacturer in China doesn't want to lose your business. Now, the people who get screwed are the U.S. small companies, retailers, Main Street stores. You can't do that kind of Amazon maneuver or Kmart maneuver or Walmart maneuver where you have that leverage. And so U.S. small businesses are paying the full freight of the tariffs. And there's a crisis of Main Street businesses that are getting clobbered because they can't negotiate that. And then those are, Ralph, the companies that are most likely to have to pass it through to their consumers because they're having to pay all of it. And then the problem there is, basically, it then sets up the small business having a much higher price than the Walmart down the street, which can negotiate to split the tariff. It's a really bad dynamic in that regard. And the markup, again, it's huge, but it's one thing if you're doing that over the rent for a store and it's a small business versus if you're a Walmart or whatever and you have so much money you can float years of maybe not making as much profit. So for the small guys, it's a real problem.
David?
I'm confused because, Laura, you helped block the Obama administration from signing the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. I always thought Congress had to approve trade deals. When did the president suddenly get unilateral power to negotiate all by himself?
So this is a very interesting question. So they can negotiate. They always have had the right to negotiate. It's part of their foreign policy rights. What they can't do, though, exactly what you're saying, is sign agreements, make agreements unilaterally. And in fact, one of the clearest checks and balances in the U.S. Constitution is around trade. Article 1, 8, Clause 8, for friends reading along at home, gives explicit authority over tariffs. They call them duties. It's capital D-U-T-I-S. It's an old-fashioned word for tariff in the Constitution. Also, another clause in Clause 8 is regulating commerce with foreign nations. And that is an exclusive congressional authority. What you're begging the question of is how the hell are they doing this without having Congress involved? And the answer is, how the hell are they doing any of the things they're doing? I mean, right now in Congress today, across town, is a rescission fight to basically undo all the appropriations, another of those really clear, only Congress can do this kind of authority. And they're basically trying to just be like, oh, well, we're giving that the raspberry. We'll just do it unilaterally. It's the same attitude. And so Congress has started a little bit to exert itself, saying, wait, you can't just do this by yourself. But the Republicans have a majority in the House and the Senate, and they're all basically so scared of Trump that most of them aren't willing to challenge it. And these are a bunch of actual dyed-in-the-wool free trade lunatics. So they're every day, they're like, it's like eating ground glass to have to go along with this. But even so, there is such an absence of spinal strength to stand up on what is a fundamental congressional right that they're kind of letting him get away with it.
Anna?
Lori, something, a phrase I see repeated is de minimis. What is a de minimis?
So here is the good news. With all of the chaos and misuse of the tariffs, because this has been like just total tariff malpractice, and by the way, the reaction to it is like making people in reaction start like thinking, well, maybe NAFTA and TPP weren't so bad. No, folks, they still totally are terrible. So is the WTO. Just because what Trump is doing is idiotic. De minimis is one place, a ray of sunshine, because we're going to kill, replace, get rid of de minimis. And that has been a project for me of many years where people were laughing at us as recently as like 5 years ago. And we said, that's got to get thrown out. So de minimis is a loophole in U.S. customs law that says that for goods now under $800 a day imported to an individual in the U.S. every day can avoid all tariffs, all taxes, and all inspection. And this loophole has been used by the Amazons, Temus, Sheins to basically import stuff that goes around the forced labor ban, endangered species products, stuff that's like, you know, not from those particular companies, but shady internet pharmacies, fentanyl-laced pills. All kinds of really dangerous and illegal stuff is coming in through this loophole. And a certain, an odd coalition of fentanyl, the families of fentanyl poisoning victims, of environmental groups worried about the endangered species stuff, of faith groups and unions worried about the forced labor stuff, of consumer rights organizations, of trade justice people like me, have been working to get this loophole closed. And so what ended up happening, ironically, is the Biden administration, just before they left, started to do a partial closing. The Trump administration picked that up and closed it down for China. So right now, the stuff that was sneaking in through China uninspected, untariffed, untaxed has been stopped. That's since May 1st. And now we're waiting for a new executive order that would stop de minimis imports from all the rest of the world. And then seeing the writing on the wall, part of that horrible, big, bastardly bill has in it a phase out by 2027 by statute of de minimis, changing the Trade Act of 1930 permanently and just getting rid of it for all commercial goods. And that, by the way, brings us up to speed with what the European Union is doing, what South Africa, Brazil, Mexico have already done. Basically, the big online retailers took a thing that had some logic, abused it, twisted it, blasted it open. And now, thank God, the United States is about to join the crew of getting rid of it. And that will be a good, positive thing that will have happened, perhaps the only, with this administration on trade.
On that point, we're out of time. We've been talking with Lori Wallach, heading Rethink Trade. And before that, for many years, the head of Global Trade Watch, a Public Citizen. Before we leave, Lori Wallach, give our listeners that website again so they can cogitate about the pluses and minuses of all this as we move into the rest of the year and all the deadlines that Trump is imposing on all these countries.
Thank you all for the opportunity to join you. And listeners, you can learn about de minimis, you can learn more about the tariffs, you can find that tariff measuring tool, and much, much more at rethinktrade.org. That's www.rethinktrade.org. If you also want to see how your member of Congress has voted on trade over time, we have the updated trade vote tracking chart. So you can see exactly where your member of Congress has come down on these issues over time. They're all going to be home for all of August recess. They're supposed to go out of Washington to be home for 6 weeks this time at the end of July. So find them at a picnic, find them in a parade, tell them you want trade justice, you want actually trade that works for working people, the environment, the planet, and safety. And if we all work hard, we can actually achieve that as the de minimis victory shows. So that's rethinktrade.org.
The Ralph Nader Hour can be heard on KPW on Mondays at 9 a.m. For KPW, I'm Curtis Blankenship.
The arguments made by Reclus and Bakunin were shared by their Federalist counterparts across the Atlantic. Victoria Woodhull, a prominent spiritualist associated with the International in New York, denounced U.S. senators who voted to deny Chinese immigrant citizenship as dancing the jump Jim Crow. Meanwhile, their Marxian-aligned rivals in the U.S., led by one Friedrich Zorga, passed a resolution decreeing that the members of the International Association of the United States are required to support the anti-Chinese political and social movement and to join it, even if they see no chance of success. One article in the San Francisco French section's organ, Le Internationale, declared that the International Association proclaims human solidarity. It wishes to apply it immediately as far as the situation allows. It is ready to admit in its bosom any member without distinction of sex, color, or nationality, but as a natural consequence of the above-mentioned principle, it demands reciprocity. Therefore, the day when a Chinese man knocks at its door with the formal intention of regulating his conduct according to said principles, he'll be welcomed. As for others, if they do not want to submit to them, if they cannot mutually contribute with us to progress and to our emancipation, if by coming to us they become the instruments with which capitalists can most surely fight and destroy our tendencies to tear us from their clutches, we say to them, withdraw, you are not one of us. In this and many other proclamations, Chinese people were blamed for white people's desire to exclude them from the United States and the International Workingmen's Association. A theoretical door was left open for future Chinese membership in a painful attempt not to contradict the organization's ostensible founding principles. But after ranting for a couple thousand words about Chinese workers' supposed servile nature and economic threat, this author clearly did not expect the opening to be utilized. The firm support of Friedrich Zorga and his allies for Chinese exclusion ultimately won him the loyalty of all three of San Francisco's sections, German, French, and American. Most German sections in the United States ultimately aligned with Zorga's and, by extension, Marx's faction, and while the French sections were rather more divided in their loyalties, San Francisco's American section was notably the only one to align itself with Zorga from the very start of the split. Take a quick water break. As the 1870s rolled on, there actually emerged a tragically failed attempt from within San Francisco to challenge the local xenophobic consensus. Some of the San Francisco American section, like Laura Cuppy Kendrick of its spiritualist wing, began to question exclusion. Much of the limited discourse available within the city's international during the mid-1870s can be found in the local radical spiritualist paper, Common Sense. Kendrick and other local internationalists, including Pat J. Healy, began arguing in favor of equal rights for all, the Chinese included. One Chinese slipper maker, Ah He Lee, even wrote into Common Sense to insist that he was in favor of the rest of the paper's radical material, but asserted bluntly that Chinese people were not to blame for the societal ills the paper campaigned against. Common Sense was edited by the radical spiritualist Slocum couple, William and Amanda. In an editorial reply to Ah He Lee, one of the Slocums indicated that they were somewhat skeptical, but granted that it remains an open question whether it would not be better for our own people to discourage the importation and employment of the Chinese. Yet Ah He Lee seems to have been the only Chinese person these local internationalists actually connected with. Their approach still seemed to be largely let them come to us. When it came to hot-button issues, these local internationalists preferred to avoid the question of race entirely rather than confront it head-on. This weak position would soon have tragic consequences and make this first attempt to challenge xenophobia in the Pacific Coast labor movement rather short-lived. The Marxian wing of the International was soon largely defunct in Europe and survived in a diminished state in the U.S. until 1876, when it merged with several other socialist groups to form the Workingmen's Party of the United States. The American Federalist Wing had already faded from the scene, but lasted longer in Europe and soon gave birth to an organized anarchist movement. In 1877, the United States was rocked by a colossal railroad strike. Amid a depression, bosses sought to impose yet another in a series of drastic wage cuts. Workers across the East Coast and Midwest rose up spontaneously and battled state militias and even federal troops in one of the largest labor uprisings in U.S. history. California's railroad barons preemptively dropped their proposed wage cuts after witnessing the resistance elsewhere. In San Francisco, members of the Workingmen's Party of the United States, the successor of the International, thus called for a solidarity meeting with the strikers to the east on July 23, 1877. In California, Chinese workers were intimately associated with railroad construction and maintenance work, and many among the 10,000 attendees of this rally at the empty sandlot in front of City Hall were certainly eagerly anticipating racist denunciations of Chinese labor. Those who spoke on the platform, including Laura Cuppy Kendrick, insisted instead that this was not an anti-Chinese meeting, merely an act of labor solidarity. Many in the crowd were not pleased. Organized anti-coolie clubs erected their own opposing platform on the sandlot and drew in a large part of the crowd. Many of them soon set off on a failed attempt to burn down Chinatown and the Pacific Mail Steamship Company's docks, sparking days of rioting throughout the city. A man named Dennis Kearney emerged from the rubble of the 1877 riots. With a handful of friends, he formed a rival Workingmen's Party of California, the name clearly a jab at the Workingmen's Party of the United States. Its slogan was ominously, "The Chinese must go." The Workingmen's Party of California soon became the first mass labor party in California. Many former internationalists and Workingmen's Party of the U.S. members joined, including William Slocum, and much of the old German section. Within the party, distinct wings quickly emerged. There was a relative consensus around xenophobia more generally, with all willing to uphold the party's racist slogan. But while Dennis Kearney long insisted that it be the only plank, others, including many ex-internationalists like Slocum, viewed it as one step in the road to a deeper transformation in labor and society. Many in the latter group came to oppose what they saw as Kearney's dictatorial rule of the party. From this group emerged a trades assembly uniting a number of trade unions, which Kearney himself opposed. Kearney's wing, though, was far larger for several years, and managed to elect numerous officials, including mayors in San Francisco, San Jose, and other California cities, as well as a large number of state legislators. They also played a key role in an 1878 convention that redrafted California's constitution, including inserting a handful of explicit anti-Chinese clauses. Kearney's Workingmen's Party faded by the early 1880s. Part of this was due to additional factional rivalries, part lay at the feet of a series of corruptionist scandals by the party's elected officials, but most importantly, perhaps, was the fact that it largely won its demands. Chinese exclusion became a broad-sweeping political consensus in California, accepted by both of the older parties, undermining the Workingmen's Party's singular plank. This ultimately helped drive the 1882 Chinese Restriction Act, the first in U.S. history explicitly banning immigration on the basis of race. In the 1880s, the concept of the International was revived. One relatively well-known group is the anarchistic International Working People's Association that grew out of an 1881 Social Revolutionaries Conference in London, organized by many former members of the old Euro Federation, the Federalist wing of the First International. This international, what I'll call the IWPA, is best remembered for its association with the 1886 Haymarket Affair that is commemorated every year on May Day. Haymarket martyrs, including Albert Parsons and August Spies, were members of the IWPA. Yet at the same time the IWPA was getting off the ground, a parallel international was emerging on the Pacific Coast in San Francisco. This group, known as the International Workmen's Association, was launched in 1882 out of a study group associated with the Trades Assembly formed by the former anti-Kearney wing of the old Workingmen's Party of California. The idea for reviving the old International apparently came from correspondence with Henry Hyndman, a London-based socialist whose Democratic Federation included members of Karl Marx's small inner circle, including his daughter Eleanor and several sons-in-law. Marx himself was on his deathbed at the time. several early members of this new International Workmen's Association from San Francisco, which I'll refer to as the IWA, maintain long-standing socialist and internationalist commitments. One founding executive member, John Redstone, was in London when the first International was founded and maintained tangential involvement. Andrew Starkweather, who wrote A Key Introduction to Socialism for the IWA, had been a long-standing socialist in San Francisco and carried banners announcing the 1877 Solidarity Rally with railroad strikers. William Slocum, the old co-publisher of Common Sense, who had joined the First International in its later years, became a prominent member of the new IWA in Sacramento and later Eureka, California. The most notorious figure associated with this newly revived International was a former lawyer named Burnett Haskell. With the invaluable assistance of his wife, Anna, Burnett published a radical newspaper called Truth that became the first organ of the new IWA. Burnett initially articulated a vision of the IWA that called for a reunion of red and black, that is, Marxian and anarchist groups, and early on preached the new radical gospel of dynamite alongside radical trade unionism while denouncing electoral activity. During this early period, Truth even published perhaps the first English translation of essays by Mikhail Bakunin and Peter Kropotkin. When the soon-to-be frenemies in the IWPA were organizing, Haskell initially reached out with proposals to merge their organization. Some of his rhetorical flourishes were incorporated into the well-known IWPA manifesto known as the Pittsburgh Proclamation. But Haskell's organizational ideas were rejected by the delegates in Pittsburgh as confused and authoritarian. The two organizations would revive the question of merging at various times, though no formal union ever fully took shape. Over time, Haskell and others within the IWA began to refer themselves to themselves as the Socialist Red International, to contrast with the growing overt anarchism of the Black International of the IWPA. Though in a rather paradoxical fashion, Haskell sometimes referred to his group as the only American International, opposed to the anarchists' foreign international. While the anarchist IWPA built a formidable base across the Midwest and East Coast, and even into the southern United States, the San Francisco-based group spread its wings across the West. Many California towns and cities had IWA groups, some of them short-lived, but others longer. Denver emerged as a major hub for the group. A leading organizer there was Joseph Buchanan, who ran a popular paper called The Labor Inquirer and who became a major figure in the Knights of Labor after he helped organize a powerful body of Union Pacific Railroad workers. The furthest eastern hub of the IWA lay in Topeka, Kansas, where a group of local socialist students and prominent Lights of Labor members joined. The IWA also had organizers in northern Mexico, British Columbia, and the then-independent Kingdom of Hawaii, while maintaining correspondence with radicals abroad in places like London, Berlin, Paris, and even South Africa. The IWA welcomed many white European immigrants into its fold, and had significant pull, especially among German immigrants. Yet it upheld the despicable local tradition in the labor movement of virulent xenophobia. Truth and the Labor Inquirer from Denver often published vile racist articles on the subject. The group's active embrace of xenophobia as an organizing strategy arose in 1885. Eureka, California, which was one of the organization's main California hubs, was primarily a lumber town. When local logging and mill companies sought to hire Chinese workers, the local Knights of Labor, which was heavily influenced by IWA members who served as officers, began a sustained anti-Chinese agitation campaign. After a local city councilman was accidentally killed in the crossfire of a gunfight between rival Chinese secret society groups, the racists saw their chance to strike. A mass meeting of white citizens formed a committee of nine, tasked with delivering the message to the Chinese community that they would all need to leave Eureka immediately. A noose was hung outside Chinatown to bring the message home. The success of this expulsion kickstarted a wave of similar expulsions across Western North America. Two men who were present in Eureka helped spread it to the Pacific Northwest. William Christie, a carpenter and Tacoma School Board member, would soon join the IWA and help spark the wave of agitation that culminated in the expulsion of Tacoma's Chinese community that started this talk. Daniel Cronin, already an IWA and Knights organizer, soon traveled to the Pacific Northwest after the events in Eureka, where he chartered Knights locals from Seattle to Portland and met in many small towns between, while more covertly organizing for the International. In most of these places, local white settlers took up Chinese expulsion as a platform on which to build their labor movement. After Tacoma's November 1885 expulsion, the army declared martial law. But when they left the Salish Sea a few months later, Knights and Internationalists in Seattle attempted their own expulsion. After the dust settled, amid gun battles between expulsionists and a law and order faction overseen by the local sheriff, only a couple dozen of Seattle's hundreds of Chinese residents remained. The next year, the Knights of Labor in Vancouver, British Columbia, attempted their own expulsion. An IWA organizer present in Eureka had also traveled there. Historian Beth Lou Williams has counted at least 160 attempted or successful expulsions across the West just in the years between 1885 and 1887. One of the deadliest of these was the September 1885 massacre in the Union Pacific coal town of Rock Springs, Wyoming, where at least 30 Chinese residents were killed in an outrage perpetrated by the local Knights of Labor who maintained ties with organizers in Denver. While not every one of the expulsions during this period known as the Driving Out were directly the work of the IWA, it played a key role in fanning the flames and helping to engineer some of the most visible tragedies. One of the few IWA members in San Francisco to speak out was the barber and former sailor Sigismund Danielewicz. At a convention in December 1885 in San Francisco aiming to organize a coast-wide labor federation, the hottest topic on the agenda was the ongoing anti-Chinese drive. Danielewicz, who played a key role in organizing a formidable IWA-affiliated Coast Sailors Union, hoped to argue against socialists identifying themselves with the anti-Chinese movements. Yet he was laughed off the stage with no support from his fellow internationalists. Danielewicz would leave the IWA soon afterwards. As the Driving Out campaign was heating up, the IWA was once again engaging in talks with their rival anarchist IWPA regarding a potential organizational merger. The IWA's xenophobic drive ended up being a factor in the failure of this merger, with some IWPA members firmly denouncing their racist involvement and insisting that their international had to embrace all workers of the world, including Chinese laborers. Yet it must be noted that the IWPA's stance was not especially firm. Some IWPA members defended their IWA counterparts, and even Albert Parsons himself was rather ambiguous on the matter. While never outright publishing denunciations of Chinese workers in his Chicago anarchist paper, The Alarm, he sometimes published punchy quotes taken from West Coast articles, but shorn of their xenophobic context. In April 1886, Parsons announced in The Alarm that he had been invited by the Comrades of San Francisco to visit the West Coast and hoped to conduct a speaking tour in Sacramento, Portland, Tacoma, Seattle, and elsewhere. Would he have denounced the racist entanglements of his West Coast counterparts? Would he have embraced them, given that 7 years before, when he was not yet an anarchist, he had once shared a stage with Dennis Kearney of the Workingmen's Party during one of Kearney's own tours to the Midwest? Or would he have tried to stay silent on the matter in front of a West Coast audience? We will never know. Mere weeks after making that announcement, dynamite flew in Chicago's Haymarket Square amid the historic May Day strike. Parsons was jailed and would soon hang. Xenophobia was tragically not the only problematic entanglement of West Coast settler radicals. From early days of the United States, a distinct settler colonial current can be traced that combined visions of genocidal manifest destiny with utopian visions of a new society for settlers themselves. From the Puritans who sought to create a city on a hill, to later millenarian Christian communism and utopian socialism, the frontier was often advanced by those paradoxically seeking to escape from capitalist civilization, only to ultimately implant it in new soil stolen from indigenous inhabitants. Over time, the act of collective colonization became a conscious radical tactic, interchanging with labor organization, politics, and insurrection. At times and in some organizations, it combined with these tactics, while others turned to colonization as other methods seemed to fail, and vice versa. As the IWA's ongoing xenophobic pogroms ultimately failed to spark full-fledged social revolution, many of the IWA's participants shifted their eyes to utopian colony building. Burnett Haskell and many California IWA members founded the Cahuilla Colony in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. In the Northwest, many of the participants in Seattle and Tacoma's IWA and broader socialist movement helped found the Puget Sound Cooperative Colony, that jump-started the nascent city of Port Angeles on the Olympic Peninsula. Others, including Daniel Cronin, formed a smaller colony in Oregon. Many other Western settler socialists, especially from Denver and Kansas, participated in a colonial venture in Sinaloa, Mexico, where they established a port at Topolobampo with the aim of serving as the terminus of a cooperatively run railroad running from the U.S. Midwest down to Sinaloa's Pacific coast. Many of these and other cooperative colonial ventures were founded on land directly stolen from indigenous people by the settler socialists. The Puget Sound Colony, for instance, was established on a beach utilized by local Klallam people as a seasonal stopover point for canoe journeys. These cooperative land projects thus served double duty as a garrison force for settler colonial land theft. While Kaweah, Puget Sound, and Topolobampo each drew in hundreds of recruits, they ultimately failed in their grander vision of forming a modelist socialist utopia that would prove their ideas on a small scale and inspire broader social transformation. The specific reasons for failure varied greatly, ranging from state repression to gradual abandonment of socialist ideals in favor of individualized business and land speculation ventures. Yet the nightmarish dream of collective colonization did not die with them. In the short term, the Pacific Northwest became a target for further colonial ventures in the 1890s, as socialists across the United States sought to co-opt the speculative growth logic of manifest destiny for their own purposes. A number of colonies were founded in Washington State as part of an intentional program by socialists across the country to focus their efforts on one young state they believed would inevitably grow exponentially. They imagined they could establish themselves early on, with a network of colonies serving as the nucleus for a broader capture of state power. In the longer run, these colonies can be seen as part of a broader tradition that includes such ignominious institutions as labor Zionist kibbutz colonies in Palestine that help establish a rank-and-file infrastructure for colonization. We must also consider how modern analogs to these 19th-century efforts can be found in numerous radical communes and land projects formed from the 1960s up to the present. Just as older colony ventures lacked any meaningful indigenous ties and often nakedly expropriated land held from time immemorial, many latter-day projects uncritically continue to imagine their utopian communities springing up from blank wildernesses. The IWA ultimately faded rather quietly into the night by early 1888, but it left a complex legacy with a number of branching afterlives. Its most direct aftermath, aside from the cooperative colonies, was the blueprint it drew up for a powerful and independent-minded white Western labor movement. Many former IWA organizers took a prominent role in forming labor unions from San Francisco to the Salish Sea and into the Rockies. Many of these unions developed a reputation for militancy and direct action, of which the anti-Chinese actions must be figured as a tragic seminal example. Sinophobia infused many of these unions for decades to come and formed the template for often racist, violently racist campaigns carried out against subsequent immigrants racialized as Asian from Japan, the Philippines, India, and elsewhere. Perhaps more optimistically, we can look to the radical networks forged by Sigismund Danielewicz after leaving the IWA over opposition to the anti-Chinese campaign. Within a few years, Danielewicz launched an anarchist newspaper in San Francisco called The Beacon that united a scattered network of West Coast radicals who sympathized with his stance and joined it with a broader network of anarchists across the continent who remained committed to attacking all authority in the aftermath of Haymarket. Correspondence to Danielewicz's paper later founded a Portland anarchist paper, The Firebrand, that served as the predecessor to the better-known San Francisco paper, Free Society, whose spiritual successor was Emma Goldman's Mother Earth. The anarchist movement increasingly took a militant anti-imperialist stance, denouncing U.S. invasions of Hawaii, the Philippines, and Cuba, while forming interracial anti-colonial alliances with global anarchist radicals. From the diasporic Sikh and Bengali Gutter Party, formed on the U.S. Pacific coast, in fact, in Astoria, Oregon, with the aim of overthrowing the British Empire in India, as well as organizing immigrant laborers, to the Japanese anarchists like Kotoko Shusue, who aimed to build a pan-Asian anti-colonial alliance while also organizing Japanese workers up and down the coast, to the anarchistic rebels of the Partido Liberal Mexicano, like the Magone brothers, who organized on both sides of the imposed southern border. one associate of the Firebrand and Free Society groups, the Slovenian immigrant Al Klemenčić, was instrumental in embedding a genuinely internationalist vision into the industrial workers of the world, the IWW. Originally living in Tacoma starting in 1893, Klemenčić moved to Hawaii and later Colorado. When some delegates at the IWW's founding convention proposed naming the new union the Industrial Union of America, anarchistic delegates passionately argued the attendees to change America to the world's. As Klemenčić argued, quoting him, "We know we have got Austrians, Chinamen, Japs, and people of all nationalities here in this country, so we've got Frenchmen, Germans, and Italians, and we are a cosmopolitan crew. All lines that were ever established and have always been established by men who are a bunch of robbers, thieves, exploiters, and we want to combine ourselves with as humanity, as one lot of people, those that are producing the wealth of our oppressors, and we want to have under that banner our brothers and sisters of the world." Yet the anti-colonial framework of these settler anarchists must still be seriously qualified with the fact that they frequently lacked a meaningful critique of American settler colonialism. White Wobblies and anarchists might have envisioned wide-ranging social change and opposed imperialism abroad, but amid their dream of overthrowing capitalist power, working-class settler radicals often positioned themselves as the rightful owners of the industrial leviathan consuming stolen land. There were certainly many indigenous Wobblies and many early anarchists. Many organized jointly with the heavily indigenous Partido Liberal Mexicano. Others, like Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh waterfront workers in Vancouver, British Columbia, focused more on local affairs. But while indigenous people found the IWW a powerful vehicle for their organizing, the broader organization largely did not concern itself with full-fledged indigenous liberation. And anarchists themselves often undertook their own colonial adventures, like this home settlement near Tacoma. Furthermore, these tenuous anti-colonial steps by Wobblies and anarchists were pitted against a far larger mainstream labor movement and a socialist movement that often enthusiastically upheld working-class articulations of American nationalism. The cosmopolitan internationalist anarchists around Firebrand, the home periodicals, Free Society, and later Mother Earth frequently discussed the land question, but their discourse was nearly exclusively rooted in a profoundly colonial lens that decried the monopolization of land by wealthy settlers at the expense of poorer ones. What if instead they had broached a deeper question? What is required of a truly anti-colonial revolution entirely against stolen land, against Leviathan itself? I can't claim to have a neat blueprint or an all-encompassing program for a path forward. One starting point would be to simply take your principles to heart with deadly seriousness. Stick to your guns if you proclaim to fight, as in the words of the general rules of the First International, for truth, justice, and morality without regard to color, creed, or nationality. Sometimes, like Sigismund Danielovich, you might get laughed off the stage at first. Don't give up. You'll connect with others willing to fight the unpopular fight. The seeds Danielovich planted took time to grow, but after 2 decades they blossomed into a profoundly dynamic movement that threw countless wrenches into the mechanical heart of Leviathan. At the same time, don't assume that whatever projects you undertake start from a blank slate. Relations always exist with what came before. If you're a white settler drawn into a land project in the woods, don't simply look at the trees and imagine untamed wilderness waiting to be molded by you and yours. Building infrastructure to take care of our needs through horizontal interdependence can't come at the expense of people who related to this land for millennia. Who around your project is struggling for land back? Is your project simply a newcomer in a long line of violent occupation? Or can you find some way to support the genuine dismantling of empire, even on a small scale?